Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are speaking to some of the most innovative minds in the world of sports nutrition. We will be discussing everything from research, practice, and performance to give you an inside look into the exciting world of combat sports performance. Today, my guest is Louise Blaw. Louise holds a Bachelor of Science in Sport and Exercise and a Postgraduate Diploma in Sports Nutrition from the International Olympic Committee. She is the current performance nutritionist at the British Judo Association and British Diving, and she has previously worked with British Taekwondo and British Boxing. In this episode, Louise and I discuss her experience in making change at a systematic and cultural level to change age-old behaviors in regards to making weight. We discuss the importance of engaging key coaches and stakeholders and educating the athletes on the performance benefit of not engaging in extreme practices. There's a lot of great info here, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live, back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Today we have Louise Blaw. Again, we're joined from another guest from our friendly England. We've had, I think, probably 80% of the guests this season from England. Louise, thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Whereabouts in England are you? Are you located right now?
I'm Sheffield, which is north.
Sheffield, north. Right near Chester, right? Is that right?
Manchester, yeah, it's in line with Manchester up north, other side of the Pennines. Just get over a few mountains and you've made it.
Yeah, okay, maybe my geography's a little off. But Louise, let's get straight to it. Let's talk about your competitive background. You've got quite a decorated athletic career and a background. Can you walk us through that and what you achieved over your career?
So my background is I'm a sprinter. I was originally a long jumper in my teens and then sustained quite a bad injury. And then when I recovered from that injury, it was a stress fracture, which kept me out for quite a while. And when I recovered from it, I ended up making the shift to sprinting because I was trying to combine work and athletics, and I just felt that was an easier route for me. So I was quite late getting into my international career as an athlete. I must have been 26, 27 when I first made international selection, so I was very determined to keep going and to get the vest, as you know, many people dream of. And then, yeah, so I made the Commonwealth team in Glasgow for the relay in 2014. We got a bronze medal there, which was great. We went to Europeans that year as well. And I was quite fortunate to be selected for the GB team running through to Rio. I had a bit of an awful year leading into Rio where I was in the shape of my life and, again, just didn't get the training load right and had a bit of a niggle. But I think I achieved things I didn't think I ever would going into as a sprinter. My feedback to athletes, you know, you've always got to back yourself. I don't think I ever fully backed, you know, 10, 15 years of training is a fantastic achievement. And obviously the dedication and determination was definitely there. So, yeah, I can definitely look back and be proud of what I achieved and definitely had a good run with it and created some amazing memories. But if I look back, got to back yourself more, got to believe yourself more, because I might have just nipped that a little bit more out of it, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do you think that competitive career and all those experience, how's that influenced your practice and your career now?
I think it definitely led me to work on the front line. Just sitting down there, working with athletes, talking with athletes, it's a natural place for me to be because that's what I was as an athlete and a practitioner. There was an overlap. Like I say, I've worked with judo for 7 years now. So there was obviously an overlap between me being an elite athlete and a practitioner. That wouldn't have been the preferred route. Obviously, you just want to, if you're going to be an athlete, you want the ideal is to focus on being an athlete if you're fortunate enough to be able to do so. I wasn't and had to work, and it was like waiting for a bus. They both came at once. So I made international selection and then managed to land myself a job in, you know, British diving and British judo. So they both kind of came at the same time. And it just made it quite tricky trying to balance those two, if you like, and trying to keep those two together. So it was tricky and it was difficult, but being able to be on the to be an athlete and work with practitioners and also be a practitioner, you were able to see both sides of things. So I think it really gave me empathy into the practitioners and how hard they work and what they have to do. And you know, it's we all know sport's not Monday to Friday 9 to 5. Everybody knows that. But I think I had a bit of a realization that, you know what, sometimes you just have to let them be. If it's weekends, if it's not an emergency, I wasn't ringing anybody. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You do need that. If you lose what days are working days and what days are rest days, that you tend to get to a point of exhaustion. And I really had a respect for that and for what they did, which I think helped a lot. But then I think it also helped me realize how to use my team, you know, as an athlete. It took a while for me to get there. I think I always felt like, because I wasn't like one of the top athletes, I always felt like I didn't want to get in the way. But eventually I kind of learned how to use my team. And now hopefully passing that on to other athletes to encourage them to use me as part of their team and to bring everybody around the table. I think that's the best thing. And also just to keep things on such a simple, essential, informal level. There's nothing I love more than going out for a coffee with an athlete and just talking food or whatever. It doesn't even have to be anything relevant to nutrition. It's just knocking down those barriers and just having that normal relationship to show that we're just two. I'm not a nutritionist, you are not an athlete. It's like we're here together on the same page. And I am a nutritionist who just believes in balance. I'm a nutritionist who loves chocolate. I'm a nutritionist, you know, loves the good stuff and the bad stuff. And the second athletes realize that, you're not the nutritionist who expects them to have, you know, the perfect plate every single time. That's when they're quite happy to sit down and just tell you everything, because the second they hold stuff back, they give you inaccurate information, they get inaccurate information in return. So I just love building those relationships and getting that truth. And the second they can walk in and sit there and go, Lou, I had a bad weekend, and they can tell me, you know, it's I just love that aspect of it, that it's a professional relationship, but at the same time there's an element of a friendship there that you've got with people in order to get things done and to get them where they need to be to achieve what they can achieve.
Yeah, for sure. Do you find the athletes respond to you a bit better because of your background and your athletic career? Do you find that they can relate to you a bit better?
I think so. It wasn't a question I really asked at the beginning. I was just kind of trying to find my way in my career and do my job. But yeah, having a few of them say, and a couple of coaches say, they've all gone, yeah, no, it does help. And they think it's good that I've done it. And I am honest with them, because I only just kind of like say started nutrition as I was an athlete. So my nutritional behaviors as an athlete improved towards the end of my career as I was figuring it out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I knew then what I knew now, obviously it'd be much better, you know, much better shape than what, I mean, I was always in good physical shape, but my practices would have been much better. But yeah, I do. I really do think it does help. And I also see it as a responsibility. And most people do actually agree with it. I see a responsibility for me to stay and maintain in good physical shape. I always say you wouldn't trust a dentist with bad teeth. Therefore, you want your sports nutritionist to also be looking after themselves and also staying in quite good shape. And I believe that quite a lot in what I do. And obviously I train 6 days a week for athletics, so I'm still going to go out there. I'm still going to go to the gym. I'm still going to work out. And I've actually found being in lockdown, my diet is probably better than ever, because you've got all the time in the world to get it right and plan it. Which is a luxury, to be honest, to not be walking out with your endless Tupperware tubs.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's get into your work with judo in particular. Can you talk to us? You've been working in judo for quite some time. Let's talk about it. Explain how your journey came to get you to working with judo athletes and how you find that.
So I used to train at the English Institute of Sport in Sheffield, and that's where GB Boxing is based. So when I started looking into nutrition, the nutritionist for GB Boxing was called Mark Ellison. It still is. So I started to liaise with Mark and do bits of shadowing with him. He's the one who directed me to the IOC diploma in sports nutrition. So I'd had a sports science degree. So I started studying that. So I was quite busy. I was working in a school. I was training 6 days a week, and I was studying a part-time master's for 2 years. So I had a very busy 2 years. But Mark was kind enough to let me shadow him around the gym, and occasionally if there's a workshop opportunity with some development athletes, I'll be able to take that. And also a bit of work with Cell Sharks as well, which was over in Manchester, which was a rugby team. And that's kind of how I started to build up experience, really. And it wasn't probably for about another 18 months that diving came up as an opportunity. And it was only 2 days a week, which they were looking for. And Mark basically offered it to me because they were keen for Mark to do the role, because he's much more experienced than I am, but he didn't have the capacity to do that. And he then passed the opportunity on to me. So I originally started working with Mark, and then 6 months later, judo came up. And judo was originally, you know, it was great because it's a combat sport, and I was really interested in the weight management element of it. And that's what makes it so unique, I think, when you work in combat sport, is that you do have that extra little weight management issue that, and because there is such a deep embedded culture, I think, across all combat sports that you have to look after. I just think that coming from boxing, where weight making was in a reasonable good position, because they'd had in 2008 Frankie Gavin failed his weight at the Olympics, and that was a well-known fact. And obviously we're funded a lot by lottery funding over here. We've got UK Sport, which govern and manage all the sports, and it's a massive thing for that to happen. And there was a lot of pressure for them to suddenly make a lot of changes and amendments. So by the time you get to 2012, 2013, when I'm starting to come in, boxing's in a pretty good place with their weight management protocols. So to go from a sport that you can see is in a pretty good place to a sport that's probably not had much nutrition support for a long time, and, you know, see food as a weight making tool as opposed to a, you know, I need to live resource, was probably quite a shock to the system. And it was in its puppy days. Judo only centralized a few months before I got there, and it centralized with a junior program. So they basically told the senior athletes that they didn't have to centralize till 2016. So we got a lot of the juniors there on that had just come up from their clubs. So there weren't any role models, and you were trying to have to work only, I think I only had a day a week when I first got there, and you can't do anything in a day a week. You know, they employed me for a day and a half, but because I lived away, I did a day and then half a day admin at home. But the reality is I'd get there at 8 and you'd leave at 7. Yeah. So you did your day. And I think I spent the first 3 years banging my head against brick wall, because you did not have the FTE. You didn't have the time to have an impact. And when I gave athletes feedback, and when I fed back to the coaches, this athlete needs X amount a week if they're going to bring the weight down safely, because they're so far off. It just didn't register, because they'd look at the number and go, no, they can do that in a week, because that's all they knew. They knew that they could crash that weight in a week. So it was very tough to begin with. I remember receiving an email, and I actually found it not long ago in my email box. It was from 2014. It's from an athlete saying that he really backed and believed what I was trying to do, but wanted me to know that as soon as I left, everybody, including the coach, just went back to default. One day a week, walk out the door, everything returns to normal, because you just didn't have the presence to keep the movement going. And that none of it was malicious. It was just their culture and all they knew. They were just doing what they knew best. And having just one young practitioner walk through the door trying to say, you need to do it this way instead, it's not going to, you're never going to succeed at that. It was the first, I can honestly say I got to Rio Olympics and I kind of questioned what I was doing as a practitioner in judo and what I'd achieved in 3 years. I really did question what I'd done. I would have left judo after 3 years and left no trace, I felt, at that moment in time.
Wow. Let's dive into that culture, Louise. What is it that you're describing when we're talking about you went in there and you'd go there for one day, but then you'd leave and they'd just go back, and they'd just go back to this kind of old culture? What is that we're talking about when we're explaining that?
It's very deep rooted, their behavior around nutrition. As I've said, they see food as a weight making tool. They don't see it as, I need my carbs, my fuel, I need my protein to recover, to build muscle, and, you know, the hydration aspects of it. They're just basic vitamins and minerals, health, bone health. They do not see any of that. They would go, and I quote, some of the athletes would say, I don't need nutrition because I don't need to make weight. And that is it. You know, me telling them that football clubs have full-time nutritionists there and they don't need to make weight, you know, any argument you can think of just did not land with them. They weren't, but that, you know, they just weren't getting it. And if you think about it, if you've grown up through a culture at club level where that's pretty much the behavior that you've seen as a child, and you grow up through, you know, to your late teens, it's going to take a while to overturn that belief. You know, because if you think of something that your parents taught you from a very young age, even if something as nice as, you know, don't forget your P's and Q's and be polite, and then somebody comes up and goes, you don't need to do that anymore, you're going to question it, you know. And all of a sudden I was going in there saying, I was asking them to eat more, which that's going to freak them out, basically. You know, you've got to be careful when you're working with a culture of athletes who may have always restricted their food and been concerned about how much they've eaten, and you're suddenly going, I need you to eat more for this session to make sure you're fueling optimally, and I need you to put something in afterwards to make sure you're replenishing your glycogen stores and recovering. They suddenly go, they're not going to eat that. Mentally, they have like, it's almost like a disordered eating, isn't it? They just have an unhealthy relationship with food. And they're not going to do that because they're going to think, well, I can't eat that because I'm going to put weight on. So they wouldn't want to do it because there's the anxiety behind food may cause weight gain. When the reality of situation that many of them that were crashing their weight and rebounding had compromised metabolisms anyway, we just obviously wasn't measuring it. But I think knowing what we know, we can assume that that was the case. And actually they need to start putting energy back in to kind of reset and find that balance again, as most of them will have spiraled it down by constantly trying to make weight. So it's very tricky. It's very tricky. And like I say, even the ones who didn't have to make weight, who sat there quite nicely, didn't want to know, even if they did have room to eat a bit more. Yes.
If we talk about the actual processes that came, you said a bit earlier that even if you pointed it out to the coach would say, it doesn't matter, we can make that in 1 week. What are the type of things that they're doing in that 1 week so they can make that said number in that given amount of time?
When I got there, when I arrived at judo, they were making weights every day. They were weighing them in every day. And I wasn't surprised by that. You know, they do that boxing, didn't surprise me at all. The issue that we had was the coaches would comment on the weight. So obviously we all know your body will fluctuate from day to day anyway. It's going to fluctuate depending on how hydrated you are, whether you've eaten enough the day before, whether you went out for a mammoth meal the day before. And if you're female, menstrual cycle can throw it up a kilo and a half in 24 hours, no problems. And none of that was really taken into account. So an athlete could get on the scales and the coach would look at it and go, what'd you weigh that for? You need to weigh a kilo less tomorrow. So the athlete would go and they'd do whatever they needed to do to weigh a kilo less tomorrow because there was that pressure had been put on them. And that could be anything, you know, like say they could just easily skip a meal. They could cut the water intake. They could go out for a run. They could do any of those things. I don't think there was anything really extreme in British judo about what they were doing. You know, we didn't have athletes that were, you know, making themselves sick or anything like that. That was really going on at that moment in time. But it was just kind of that extreme behaviour that then just led to that crash that gave the false reading on the scale, which was a false reading because you know more than anyone else, you stop eating and drinking, you lose weight. You start eating and drinking, you're going to put it back on again. So that was most of the main issue. And I actually saw one of the coaches a few years later, it was 2-3 years ago now, he was going for a run and it must've been about 25 degrees, which is rare in Britain, but it was really hot summer we had a couple of years ago. He was going out for a run and he got all these jackets on. And I was like, why are you going out for running all those jackets? It's like, oh, you know, you can run harder if you got all your jackets on. And I'm like, no, you can't. All you're doing is stressing your body. You know, you're sweating. You're going to make yourself hotter. Your thermoregulator is going to suffer. And your RPE is going to be much higher. And you're going to find it harder. It's like, I'm like, are we not, you know, and we had a good laugh about it. I'm like, are we not learning? You know what? Credit to the guy. He now goes for a run. If it's a hot day, I'll just go out in a t-shirt. It's like the message is getting through, but it takes a long time and you have to repeat yourself a lot and just keep going over it. But hopefully when the athletes see the coach going out without 50,000 jackets on, they'll believe that they can do it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about that, Louise. How do we go about changing that culture? But by the sounds of it, by the time you got to GB Judo, that was pretty embedded. That was stuck right in there like gum on a shoe. And how did you go about changing that? What were the type of things? What type of systems did you put in place? How did you talk to these athletes from top to bottom? How did it happen?
How long have we got? There's been a few failings, admittedly. There's been numerous failings. And first of all, I think it's important to state that I did not do it on my own. Under no circumstances is this kind of thing ever getting done on your own. You're just not going to succeed with that. When we first came in, I think after Rio, there was a bit of a staff turnover. And I think that went in my favour with the kind of personalities that then came in. We had a physio, Dave Hart, who was absolutely phenomenal. And he took obviously athlete health very importantly. His history was football. and he took athlete health very seriously. So he came in and he could see what was going on. We discussed what was going on, and he was very, very passionate about making sure that we could upskill coaches and regulate it. We also had something called a HOPS in the EIS, which is the his role is basically to ensure that he can link sports medicine with coaches, so to align the two. So he was basically supposed to be the bridge. That again also really, really helped. The fact that that basically meant that even though now I was 2 days a week, it meant that when my back was turned, I'd got other people continuing the message that I was trying to give. And that made a huge difference, made a massive difference. Another thing that judo is really good at is staff away days. So we'll shut the center down for a day, give the athletes a rest day, and they will go and we'll all sit in a room, and whatever the agenda is, we'll all put our heads together and, you know, just basically get out whatever the problem is, or whatever we need to, what a piece of work we need to put together. And this specific one was weight making. And we aired everything, the good, the bad, the ugly, it all came out. Obviously there were rules, you have to speak with each other with respect, and, you know, it got a bit heated, but everything just got out. The coaches who maybe didn't buy into what you were doing, the coaches who did, the staff, the thought, the consequence, you know, the health implications of it, everything was just aired, and it just all went up into the air, all got written down, and then you started to form a process of how to move forward. And I think that's the important thing to know, is that this is not ever in any club going to be resolved within a year, within 2 years. It is a long process. So from that, we then looked at weight management strategy, which we put in place using the health guidelines of how to lose weight gradually. So, you know, you can lose maximum 1% per week, which should enable you to support your training by putting your carbs around your training, keep your protein high, maintain the lean mass that you want to keep. And we put that in place and gave them the maximum allowance. And then we opted for a 3% dehydration limit 24 hours before weighing. We knew we could get away with 4, was safe, but you've got to trust that they're hydrated before they dehydrate that 3%. And we couldn't trust that because we didn't have the staff in to test it. So we went for 3%. I always argued, I said, look, if you want to weigh them, you need to be weighing them every day, because that actually got removed because of issues with athletes and concerns over eating behaviours and crashing weigh-ins every day. I said, if you're going to do it, I said, you need to be weighing them every single day, because if you have got an athlete who's crashing, they won't be able to sustain it every day. You know, eventually, and it's not a case, the athletes saw it as catching out, and that was the problem. The athletes said, if you weigh us every single day, why don't you trust us? Why are you trying to catch us out? And I'm like, it's not catching you out, it's supporting you. We know where you are, we can go, you're struggling, we need to help. It was that, but the athletes saw it as, you're spying on us. Anyway, the coaches didn't have the staff to weigh in every single day. And as you know, the competition schedule was crazy. They were all over the country. So they opted for 2 days a week. And I warned against that. I said, 2 days a week, you'll find one athlete that will crash those 2 days a week. And long story short, we did have an athlete who was crashing 2 days a week, and it got very difficult. She was very challenging. And eventually, you know, the issue, one of the main downfalls with judo is they're really bad at adhering to their consequences. So they say they're going to do something and they don't always do it, or they do it once and they don't do it again. And eventually the athletes see through it. And basically the whole weight management strategy after about 18 months just went under. It just wasn't sustainable. They weren't adhering to the policy, the consequences. We didn't have the staff to weigh them in. We didn't have enough. The coaches were basically forbidden from weighing athletes in. So we said, and that was, the athletes agreed with that. The athletes said, we don't want coaches to weigh them in. So we had to have sports medicine staff weighing them in, which was very female orientated at the time, which put a lot of pressure on the only two male physios we had to come in for 7:30 weigh-ins before training started. And it was just, there was a multitude of reasons why it failed. Multitude, which we have all aired. We've had another one of our staff away days and another one separate for the athletes. And we've all gone, why didn't this work? What do we need to do now? So yeah, it was very, very tricky. And I think within that time, it's also important to note that we did have a couple of girls who withdrew from a major competition. It wasn't a World or a Europeans, but it was a pretty big Grand Slam. And they phoned up 24 hours before and said, I'm not getting on that flight. They had a breakdown. They said, I can't do this anymore. I can't keep making weight like this. I can't live my life like this. And they admitted to just being able to eat just rice and chicken. And that was it. And that was all they were eating. They didn't put any sauce on their food. They didn't put, one said, I can't even have a boyfriend because I didn't go out for a meal. And they were just in such a bad way, a really, really bad way. And I think that was the tipping point. I think that was the Frankie Gavin of boxing. That really rocks the boat. And again, I think I've got a really good relationship with these girls, still have to this day. They still compete. And I think what really hurt is that, again, I apologized to them afterwards because I just said, I'm so sorry. I said, but I needed something to happen. And I'd already said that to my colleagues. I said, the reality of the situation is, unfortunately, we're sitting here waiting for a car crash to happen. I said, we're waiting for something awful to go wrong before people go, we need to change. Because the science wasn't enough. People's previous experiences with bad weight making wasn't enough. Something awful had to happen. And I suppose in hindsight, I'm kind of grateful that the awful thing that happened wasn't anything, you know, nobody ended up in hospital. You know, people die from making weight. I'm grateful it wasn't anything that was anything close to being that severe. But it did impact their lives for 4 to 6 months, you know. They didn't, the sport, judo was brilliant. They supported them every step of the way. They continued to fund them. They gave them all the time they needed. It was manic for me trying to re-educate and rebuild with food. They didn't weigh themselves for months. We didn't do any body composition data for months. It was all totally down to them. It was down to their they had control over the pace. And they just popped in the office whenever they were ready, and we'd go and get a coffee and we'd talk about food, and they got confident with logging their food and they started to understand it, and they called me when they were in the supermarket about what they could have. And eventually we got them back to making weight. Some of the best people in the program that can make weight are those two girls at the minute. They thoroughly understand nutrition. They understand their food. They went from being totally void in the kitchen, unable to cook, to their Instagram is like, they're making fantastic meals on Instagram, you know. And I think what's nice now is that, I say nice, it's actually quite strange really, but they actually turn around and say they wouldn't change it. You know, they say they wouldn't change what happened because they learned so much from it, and it's putting them in the position that they are today with a fantastic relationship with food. They went from, one of them went from eating 1,000 calories a day to eating about, her last report was to 2,700 she can record. If she records anything over that, she starts to freak out. She says, I know I've eaten more because there's been, you know, oil in my pan and stuff like that, but she doesn't like to see the number. But the fact that she's probably pushing 3,000 calories when she's training full time now is brilliant. And that just makes it so much easier to find that deficit. So much easier to find deficit. So we're getting there, but it's, you know, it's sad that you had to see that happen in order for to see that change.
Hey guys, I just quickly want to give a shout out to the team over at Macro Mike, only because snacking is my favorite thing to do in this life, and Macro Mike has changed the game when it comes to healthy snacks. What they do is use clean and healthy plant-based ingredients, and they make healthy versions of all of those things that you thought you weren't supposed to eat. They make peanut butter and mixes for cookies, brownies, and donuts that you can whip up in literally minutes. And best of all, these are all completely clean and taste beyond phenomenal. They also make protein supplements, protein bars, plant-based aminos, and a great product for your gut health called the Gut Doctor. The flavors that these guys have are seriously insane. Some of my favorites are chocolate hazelnut, Hawaiian salted vanilla, and strawberry jam donut. For a self-confessed snacker, these are a lifesaver. They've been nice enough to give my listeners 10% with the code TFD10, so you guys can try them for yourself. Alrighty, back to the show.
For sure. So Louise, me sitting back and listening to that, it does sound like, even though that the science may not have been there, or even if you had the science there and you're preaching this to the coaches and everything, there was a big logistical and policy and in-house environment on how you actually put this to place to get the buy-in of all the right stakeholders and then get the buy-in of the athlete. Why do you think that is? Why is that happening? Is this part of the reason why we have this problem and this continued problem across the combat sports when it comes to making weight? Is it purely a structural problem within, say, the different houses, say judo GB or AIS judo or whatever it is? Is it structural and policy within there, or is it simply a lack of education, or is it a combination, or what are your thoughts on it?
I think it's a combination. Like I say, the policy that we had, we actually took it to board. We took it to board and had it signed. And the reason why we had to do that is because we actually got overruled by a very high person in judo when I was trying to pull somebody from making weight badly. And I overruled it. I said no. Medical said no. Physio said no. And then somebody who doesn't even work on the shop floor, who knows nothing about nutrition and weight making, said, yeah, they can go, because they complained to the top. So we had to take our policy to the board to say, this is why we said no. Please forbid anybody for overruling medical when we're concerned about someone's health. That was an issue. The fact that it was quite easy just to complain to somebody and they go, yeah, of course they can fight. That was a concern. But yeah, I think lack of education is definitely an issue. It is definitely an issue. I think what we've built up in judo now is we've got plenty of case studies to show when it goes wrong and when it goes well. And that's not just me telling those case studies, it's athletes that are happy to tell those case studies as well. So they're quite happy to go out there and talk to younger athletes. They're happy to talk to our academy. They're happy to talk to the coaches about their experiences of how bad it was when it went wrong, and how they feel now they've got it right, and the difference it's made, not just their performance, but their mental health and just general well-being. That makes a massive difference because they're hearing it from one of their own. You know, I think I come from, as you know, a track and field background. So initially I was just probably seen as an intruder. I was threatening their sport. I was threatening their identity as to who they were and who they wanted to be. And that's not okay. So I think it's important that now we've got that evidence in judo and that success in judo, that we continue to use that down the pathway to make that shift. Because like I said, when I got to judo, we didn't have any role models. There were no role models. There was nobody that was doing it right. Now there is. There are role models that do it right. And what we recognize with weight making is that either those who sit on their weight naturally, or those who can make weight gradually and can transfer that energy from good weight making onto the mat, they're the ones that are successful repeatedly. You might find ones that occasionally have success with a crashed weight, and we've got evidence of that, you know, but you just don't want the occasional win. You want success time and time and time again. And that's what everybody wants. So we're seeing more frequent success with those athletes who can manage their weight well or sit on their weight category. And that's really important. But we've not gotten to a point yet where we're able to get it down the pathway. We had a meeting about a month ago now with the pathway managers and their safeguarding officer, if I'm honest. Because like you say, the biggest issue is it's almost like it's the triad. The person who's the coach, who's the ex-judo player, and who's the mum or the parent. That's the biggest one to tackle. So I don't know how you tackle those. And again, it's not a one-year fix. We had a large discussion, and I am currently at the minute putting together education on some of the conversations that we had with the coaches. So we asked the coaches, which was absolutely brilliant. We said, how did weight making make you feel? And how would you want to feel? And what they said was so incredibly emotive. You know, it was lonely. It was changed personality. It was despair. It was sickness and diarrhea. It was part of the process. It's part of judo. It's what it is. We asked the athletes the same, you know, stress, loss of energy. And then when we said, how do you want to feel? You know, one of the athletes put something simple as, I have had breakfast. You know, I want to feel indestructible. I want to feel the best that I can be. And everybody can associate with that. I'm going to take those questions down the pathway. You know, I want athletes, I want coaches, I want judo players to sit there and to reflect. And if you've never had to make weight, I want people to have the conversations with people who have had to make weight. So I want to make it as tangible as possible and make it as emotive as possible so that people can start to really empathize with, this is what weight making is. This is how it makes you feel. Because when I heard the coaches, the people, they're my friends, you know, we really care about those people. I wasn't leading that workshop and I found it really hard to listen to, really hard. And I want other people to kind of feel what I felt about that and to recognize that all the negatives. It doesn't have to be that way. We want them to take as much energy onto the mat, and that will lead to better performance, which fundamentally is what everybody wants. But we want people to get there the best way they possibly can. So I'm in the process now of just building up those workshops, and whether it's, you know, just, I don't know, 3 to 5 workshops where we talk together about those issues. And then I talk to them about REDS, and I talked about the impacts of concussion and hydration and fluid around the brain, things like that. Hopefully if we can do that, that will hopefully make people start to think about it. But also I think judo at the top, the way they're now running their program, as soon as you get through the door as an academy player, you're not selected for your weight category. You're selected because you're a good judo player. And we encourage that growth. And I think we need to lead at the top by showing people that we don't let people make weight badly, and you won't be seeing our guys sat in saunas, you know, to a dangerous level, especially at a junior age group, that you're encouraged to grow, develop good bone health. All those things is really important to us. So I think we need to lead from the top, but at the same time, we need to get the education right. It needs to filter down to grassroots. And I want that education to be as emotive and as tangible as it possibly can be, so that people don't just think we're preaching to them. It's genuinely because I'm very passionate and because I care. And I think the issue is that speaking to some of the athletes on the program about their relationship with food, the damage was done long before they got through the door. I had one girl who, the reason why they originally stopped weighing them once a day, they all said that she had eating disorder, and she did what she didn't. But when I spoke to her about it, I said, "What caused that? What caused that angst around food?" And she said it happened the first day she walked to a dojo as a young child. So she walked to a dojo, and the first thing they did was they put on the scales. She weighed about 56 kg, and they said, "Oh, you can be a 52 kilo fighter." And then a few weeks later, she was given a present. That present was a sweatsuit. And she said the problem started there. And, you know, that's what needs to change. The recognition of how children shouldn't be making weight. That's what needs to change. And, you know, we can educate, and I, as best we can do what we can at British Judo, but I often question what we need to do at the top. You know, what does the International Judo Federation need to do around practices for young athletes, and I don't know how we change it. I don't know what the answer is to that. Definitely some of the people who work in Pathways, who travel to those competitions, would have maybe more ideas, having seen it. But you know, what do we do for kids that actually do make weight for competitions when they should be growing? I think that's a concern. As I say, I don't have the answers for that as of yet. It's something that we're only just getting to on the program now. But I think we can do all we can from a UK perspective, and you guys can do all you can do. But the question is, does the IGF need to change what they're doing and how it's regulated from their perspective?
Absolutely. Hey, Louise, if you were to meet yourself 7 years ago, you met the person that walked into judo for the first time and you said, "Hey, I know everything I know now. These are my top tips for you to shortcut this process." And I guess this is really the advice for anyone else who may be in your position. If they're a practitioner and they walk into this environment and they notice, they will notice this culture, because it's in all combat sports. What advice would you give yourself 7 years ago? "Hey, this is what you need to do to start this process."
I would have looked around the coaches. I'd have looked around the team. We did originally, and we don't anymore, but we did have some very challenging personalities in there. They didn't want it. They were quite, I always said they were quite toxic, the environment. You need to pick those people out. They need to be on side. But you need to have everybody. You need allies. You need people. If you want to get it done quick, you need a big team, and you need those people on your side, and you need people beating that drum when you're not there to be able to do so. That is the main thing. I think also now I have a lot of knowledge and experience around just how to test the athletes. You know, we can RMR them, test their resting metabolic rate, and whether it's compromised 50 meters as the crow flies from where we're at. It's like, I would be better at gathering data and evidence for what we've got, to be able to hopefully show them you're compromised. This, you know, you need to eat more, we need to enhance this, you need to stop, you know, we need to, basically it's termed reverse dieting, isn't it? Where you eat more and get your metabolism back up and running. So those were skills that I didn't have when I first started, because I literally walked in there with very little, I'm surprised that I was ever sent in there, to be honest. I wouldn't send me in there again 7 years ago with no knowledge. Absolutely not. I think it's really difficult. I think it's incredibly difficult walking into a culture that has such deep-rooted behaviours with no evidence of success within that sport. Because even when I got evidence from different sports, I was back aimed with, but that's not judo. And they're right. To be fair, they're right. Judo is unique, and I've learned that more and more. I think I definitely put more emphasis around them getting knowledge around their behavior and how that impacts muscle growth. And I discussed this before in a previous presentation with how judo is hypertrophy. You know, you're constantly gripping, you're constantly picking up, physically picking up another human being, and you're throwing them. I was like, you do that in a S&C gym, you know, that's S&C. You're increasing lean mass, which is why I have a lot of trouble around keeping people in those categories sometimes. You know, you 60 kilo lads, gone. They'll grow out of it really easily. Really easily. And it took me a while to pick up on that because I was so obviously mind blown with everything else that I was looking out for, that all of a sudden I'm like, in boxing, you know, I'd be giving examples and I'd be giving information of, oh, if you want to lose lean mass, this is what you've got to do. And I'm thinking, but it's not working. And so even in the energy deficit, because they're constantly picking people up and throwing them, even if you've got the muscle off, as soon as they put food back in again, it goes straight back on, you know, and I'm stuck in this cycle. I think that's a big one for me to get through to people when you walk through the door. You know why they're struggling? Because look at the training you're doing. Look at what the stimulus is. That is really, really big. I think it's tough. I've not actually thought about like how I structure it if I walk through the door again. It would be a pretty big plan, I think, a pretty big plan that needs to be executed. And I think it's important to get your speaker right as well. I think what helped me a lot was Dave, the physio. He led a lot of the talks, which was so useful because I think I got sick of speaking. I think they're probably sick of listening to me speak. And I think hearing it from somebody else also helps. Getting somebody else to come in and share the same message that you're trying to give really helps. People start to listen because they're not just hearing it from one person. They start to hear it from a multitude of people, and then it starts to make a noise the more people talk about it. And I think I got quite proud when I could sit in a meeting and listen to everybody talk about the pros and cons of weight making. I didn't have to say a word. So I was like, they know it. They know it. They all know it. Every single one of those coaches now, they know and they understand and they get it and they value it and they buy into what we're trying to do. I don't really need to be there for those conversations, you know, because I've taught them everything they need to know. And I think when realization that had happened, when the coaches were educated and they all bought in, I think I was quite proud of that, and I'm quite proud of them for where they've come, to be honest. Because that's when the movement will really, really start to move at pace. And you've got that buy-in.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. All right, Louise, that's great. I think that's filled with fantastic information. It is. It's a very, very complex issue. And I don't think anyone, like I talk to a lot of people on this podcast, like a lot of people who I consider world leaders, world-renowned experts. And I don't think one person has been able to give an answer because there just isn't one. Well, not right now, but you know what? I think practitioners like yourself and other people coming around, we're getting there. We're going to get there and it's getting better. So last thing, Louise, last thing, if people are listening to this and they go, wow, I want to hear more about what Louise is doing. I want to follow her work. I want to get in contact with her. I've got a million and one questions I want to ask her. What's the best way for them to do that?
I have email. I have Twitter. I'm new to on Twitter, but you know, I don't know, maybe if people encourage me, I'll get a bit better. my email, I'll go personal, I'll go for EIS actually, email louise.blore@eistowin.co.uk. That one's a great one. And my Twitter, I think is louise.blore, I think. I say I'm rubbish on it. And my Instagram, I think is louise_blore. But those are definitely the best ways to get in touch. On there, I think I would love to be talking to people about this more and more, about their experiences in it. I hear judo is a complex, and I don't think in any any of the combat sports out there, as I said before, none of it is malicious. It's just a culture thing. It's just all they know. And it is a very hard thing to upturn. And I don't think there is, like you say, I don't think there is a process that's a one fit all for every judo club, whether it's a small club or whether you're working, you know, internationally or nationally, whatever. I don't think there is a process for that. I think you've just got to go in, see the culture, see the personality, see the coaches, because every coach is different and you've got to approach them differently. And every athlete is different. So, yeah, you need to just get in there and see what cards you've been dealt before you decide to play.
Yeah, that's right. Some people get worse cards than others, some people better. Anyway, Louise, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. It's a great episode, and I'm sure we'll chat soon.
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Louise makes so many important points about this topic, mainly that we can have all of the science and studies in the world, but they will mean nothing if we do not make a systematic change within the culture of the different combat sports. Fortunately, the great work that Louise is doing is showing that this can be done, and hopefully we see this being mirrored all around the world by many different organizations. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.